Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 12 of The Two Brothers by Honoré de Balzac, translated by Catherine Prescott Wormley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bruce Peary. At 4 o'clock, Joseph crossed the open space which separated the Rouget house from the Auchan house, a sort of avenue of weakly lindens, 200 feet long and of the same width as the Rue Grande Narette. When the nephew arrived, Kowski, in polished boots, black cloth trousers, white waistcoat, and black coat, announced him. The table was set in the large hall, and Joseph, who easily distinguished his uncle, went up to him, kissed him, and bowed to Flora and Max. "We have not seen each other since I came into the world, my dear uncle," said the painter gaily, "but better late than never." "You are very welcome, my friend," said the old man, looking at his nephew in a dull way. "Madame," Joseph said to Flore with an artist's vivacity, "this morning I was envying my uncle the pleasure he enjoys in being able to admire you every day."
"Isn't she beautiful?" said the old man, whose dim eyes began to shine.
"Beautiful enough to be the model of a great painter."
"Nephew," said Rouget, whose elbow Flore was nudging, "this is Monsieur Maxence Gillet, a man who served the Emperor, like your brother, in the Imperial Guard."
Joseph rose and bowed.
"Your brother was in the Dragoons, I believe," said Maxence. "I was only a dust trotter."
"On foot or on horseback," said Flore, "you both of you risked your skins."
Joseph took note of Max quite as much as Max took note of Joseph. Max, who got his clothes from Paris, was dressed as the young dandies of that day dressed themselves, a pair of light blue cloth trousers made with very full plates covered his feet so that only the toes and the spurs of his boots were seen. His waist was pinched in by a white waistcoat with chased gold buttons, which was laced behind to serve as a belt. The waistcoat, buttoned to the throat, showed off his broad chest, and a black satin stock obliged him to hold his head high in soldierly fashion. A handsome gold chain hung from a waistcoat pocket, in which the outline of a flat watch was barely seen. He was twisting a watch-key of the kind called a criquet, which Bourguet had lately invented.
"The fellow is fine-looking," thought Joseph, admiring with a painter's eye the eager face, the air of strength, and the intellectual grey eyes which Max had inherited from his father the noble.
"My uncle must be a fearful bore, and that handsome girl takes her compensations. It is a triangular household, I see that." At this instant, Baruch and Francois entered.
"Have you been to see the Tower of Issoudun?" Flore asked Joseph. "No? Then if you would like to take a little walk before dinner, which will not be served for an hour, we will show you the great curiosity of the town."
"Gladly," said the artist, quite incapable of seeing the slightest impropriety in so doing. While Flore went to put on her bonnet, gloves, and cashmere shawl, Joseph suddenly jumped up, as if an enchanter had touched him with his wand, to look at the pictures.
"Ah, you have pictures indeed, uncle," he said, examining the one that had caught his eye.
"Yes," answered the old man. "They came to us from the Descoings, who bought them during the Revolution, when the convents and churches in Berry were dismantled." Joseph was not listening. He was lost in admiration of the pictures.
"Magnificent!" he cried. "Oh, what painting! That fellow didn't spoil his canvas. Dear, dear, better and better, as it is at Nicolet's."
"There are 7 or 8 very large ones up in the garret, which were kept on account of the frames," said Gilet.
"Let me see them,"
cried the artist, and Max took him upstairs.
Joseph came down wildly enthusiastic.
Max whispered a word to the Rabouilleuse, who took the old man into the embrasure of a window, where Joseph heard her say, in a low voice, but still so that he could hear the words,
"Your nephew is a painter. You don't care for those pictures. Be kind and give them to him."
"It seems," said Jean-Jacques, leaning on Flore's arm to reach the place where Joseph was standing in ecstasy before an albano, "it seems that you are a painter."
"Only a rapper," said Joseph.
"What may that be?" asked Flore.
"A beginner," replied Joseph.
"Well," continued Jean-Jacques, "if these pictures can be of any use to you in your business, I give them to you, but without the frames. Oh, the frames are gilt, and besides, they are very funny. I will put..."
"Well done, uncle," cried Joseph, enchanted. "I'll make you copies of the same dimensions which you can put into the frames."
"But that will take your time, and you will want canvas and colors," said Flore. "You will have to spend money. Come, Père Rouget, offer your nephew 100 francs for each copy. Here are 27 pictures, and I think there are 11 very big ones in the garret which ought to cost double. Call the whole 4,000 francs. Oh, yes," she went on, turning to Joseph, "your uncle can well afford to pay you 4,000 francs for making the copies, since he keeps the frames. But, bless me, you'll want frames, and they say frames cost more than pictures. There's more gold on them. Answer, monsieur," she continued, shaking the old man's arm.
"Eh? It isn't dear. Your nephew will take 4,000 francs for new pictures in the place of the old ones."
"It is," she whispered in his ear, "a very good way to give him 4,000 francs. He doesn't look to me very flush."
"Well, nephew, I will pay you 4,000 francs for the copies."
"No, no," said the honest Joseph. 4,000 francs and the pictures? That's too much. The pictures, don't you see, are valuable."
"Accept, simpleton," said Flore. "He is your uncle, you know."
"Very good, I accept," said Joseph, bewildered by the luck that had befallen him, for he had recognized a Perugino.
The result was that the artist beamed with satisfaction as he went out of the house with the Rabouilleuse on his arm, all of which helped Maxence's plans immensely. Neither Flore, nor Rouget, nor Max, nor indeed anyone in Issoudun, knew the value of the pictures, and the crafty Max thought he had bought Flore's triumph for a song, as she paraded triumphantly before the eyes of the astonished town, leaning on the arm of her master's nephew, and evidently on the best of terms with him. People flocked to their doors to see the crab girl's triumph over the family. This astounding event made the sensation on which Max counted, so that when they all returned at 5 o'clock, nothing was talked of in every household but the cordial understanding between Max and Flore and the nephew of old Rouget. The incident of the pictures and the 4,000 francs circulated already. The dinner, at which Lousteau, one of the court judges, and the mayor of Issoudun were present, was splendid. It was one of those provincial dinners lasting 5 hours. The most exquisite wines enlivened the conversation. By 9 o'clock, at dessert, the painter, seated opposite to his uncle and between Flore and Max, had fraternized with the soldier and thought him the best fellow on earth. Joseph returned home at 11 o'clock, somewhat tipsy. As to old Rouget, Kowski had carried him to his bed, dead drunk. He had eaten as though he were an actor from foreign parts, and had soaked up the wine like the sands of the desert. "Well," said Max, when he was alone with Flore, "isn't this better than making faces at them? The Bridaux are well received. They get small presents, and are smothered with attentions, and the end of it is they will sing our praises, they will go away satisfied, and leave us in peace. Tomorrow morning you and I and Kowski will take down all those pictures and send them over to the painter, so that he shall see them when he wakes up. We will put the frames in the garret and cover the walls with one of those varnished papers which represent scenes from Telemachus, such as I have seen at Monsieur Mouilleron's." "Oh, that will be much prettier," said Flore. On the morrow, Joseph did not wake up till midday. From his bed he saw the pictures, which had been brought in while he was asleep, leaning one against another on the opposite wall. While he examined them anew, recognizing each masterpiece, studying the manner of each painter, and searching for the signature, his mother had gone to see and thank her brother, urged thereto by old Auchan, who, having heard of the follies the painter had committed the night before, almost despaired of the Rideau cause. "Your adversaries have the cunning of foxes," he said to Agathe. "In all my days I never saw a man carry things with such a high hand as that soldier. They say war educates young men. Joseph has let himself be fooled. They have shut his mouth with wine, and those miserable pictures, and 4,000 francs. Your artist hasn't cost Maxence much." The long-headed old man instructed Madame Rideau carefully as to the line of conduct she ought to pursue, advising her to enter into Maxence's ideas and cajole Flore so as to set up a sort of intimacy with her and thus obtain a few moments' interview with Jean-Jacques alone. Madame Bridau was very warmly received by her brother, to whom Flore had taught his lesson. The old man was in bed, quite ill from the excesses of the night before. As Agathe, under the circumstances, could scarcely begin at once to speak of family matters, Max thought it proper and magnanimous to leave the brother and sister alone together. The calculation was a good one. Poor Agathe found her brother so ill that she would not deprive him of Madame Brasier's care. "Besides," she said to the old bachelor, "I wish to know a person to whom I am grateful for the happiness of my brother." These words gave evident pleasure to the old man, who rang for Madame Flore. Flore, as we may well believe, was not far off. The female antagonists bowed to each other. The Rabouilleuse showed the most servile attentions and the utmost tenderness to her master, fancied his head was too low, beat up the pillows, and took care of him like a bride of yesterday. The poor creature received it with a rush of feeling. "We owe you much gratitude, mademoiselle," said Agathe, "for the proofs of attachment you have so long given to my brother, and for the way in which you watch over his happiness." "That is true, my dear Agathe," said the old man. "She has taught me what happiness is. She is a woman of excellent qualities." "And therefore, my dear brother, you ought to have recompensed mademoiselle by making her your wife. Yes, I am too sincere in my religion not to wish to see you obey the precepts of the church.
You would each be more tranquil in mind if you were not at variance with morality and the laws. I have come here, dear brother, to ask for help in my affliction, but do not suppose that we wish to make any remonstrance as to the manner in which you may dispose of your property.
Madame, said Flore, we know how unjust your father was to you. Monsieur here can tell you, she went on, looking fixedly at her victim, that the only quarrels we have ever had were about you. I have always told him that he owes you part of the fortune he received from his father, and your father, my benefactor, for he was my benefactor, she added in a tearful voice, I shall ever remember him. But your brother, madame, has listened to reason.
Yes, said the old man, when I make my will, you shall not be forgotten.
Don't talk of these things, my dear brother. You do not yet know my nature.
After such a beginning, it is easy to imagine how the visit went on. Rouget invited his sister to dinner on the next day but one. We may here mention that during these 3 days, the nights of idleness captured an immense quantity of rats and mice, which were kept half-famished until they were let loose in the green one fine night, to the number of 436, of which some were breeding mothers. Not content with providing Fario's storehouse with these boarders, the knights made holes in the roof of the old church and put in a dozen pigeons taken from as many different farms. These four-footed and feathered creatures held high revels, all the more securely because the watchman was enticed away by a fellow who kept him drunk from morning till night, so that he took no care of his master's property. Madame Brideau believed, contrary to the opinion of old O'Shaw, that her brother had as yet made no will. She intended asking him what were his intentions respecting Mademoiselle Brazier as soon as she could take a walk with him alone, a hope which Flore and Maxence were always holding out to her, and, of course, always disappointing. Meanwhile, the knights were searching for a way to put the Parisians to flight, and finding none that were not impracticable follies. At the end of a week, half the time the Parisians were to stay in Issoudun, the Brideaus were no farther advanced in their object than when they came.
"Your lawyer does not understand the provinces," said old O'Shaw to Madame Brideau. "What you have come to do can't be done in 2 weeks, nor in 2 years. You ought never to leave your brother, but live here and try to give him some ideas of religion. You cannot countermine the fortifications of Flore and Maxence without getting a priest to sap them. That is my advice, and it is high time to set about it."
"You certainly have very singular ideas about the clergy," said Madame Auchan to her husband.
"Ah," exclaimed the old man, "that's just like you pious women."
"God would never bless an enterprise undertaken in a sacrilegious spirit," said Madame Brideau. "Use religion for such a purpose? Why, we should be more criminal than Flore."
This conversation took place at breakfast, François and Baruch listening with all their ears.
"Sacrilege!" exclaimed old O'Shaw. "If some good abbé, keen as I have known many of them to be, knew what a dilemma you are in, he would not think it sacrilege to bring your brother's lost soul back to God, and call him to repentance for his sins, by forcing him to send away the woman who causes the scandal,
with a proper provision, of course, and showing him how to set his conscience at rest by giving a few thousand francs a year to the seminary of the archbishop, and leaving his property to the rightful heirs. The passive obedience which the old miser had always exacted from his children, and now from his grandchildren, who were under his guardianship, and for whom he was amassing a small fortune, doing for them, he said, just as he would for himself, prevented Baruch and François from showing signs of surprise or disapproval. But they exchanged significant glances expressing how dangerous and fatal such a scheme would be to Max's interest. "The fact is, madame," said Baruch, "that if you want to secure your brother's property, the only sure and true way will be to stay in Issoudun for the necessary length of time." "Mother," said Joseph hastily, "you had better write to Desroches about all this. As for me, I ask nothing more than what my uncle has already given me." After fully recognizing the great value of his 39 pictures, Joseph had carefully unnailed the canvases and fastened paper over them, gumming it at the edges with ordinary glue. He then laid them one above another in an enormous wooden box, which he sent to Desroches by the carrier's wagon, proposing to write him a letter about it by post. The precious freight had been sent off the night before. "You are satisfied with a pretty poor bargain," said Monsieur Auchan.
"I can easily get 150,000 francs for those pictures," replied Joseph.
"Painter's nonsense!" exclaimed old Auchan, giving Joseph a peculiar look.
"Mother," said Joseph, "I am going to write to Desroches and explain to him the state of things here. If he advises you to remain, you had better do so. As for your situation, we can always find you another like it."
"My dear Joseph," said Madame Auchan, following him as he left the table, "I don't know anything about your uncle's pictures, but they ought to be good, judging by the places from which they came. If they are worth only 40,000 francs, 1,000 francs apiece, tell no one. Though my grandsons are discreet and well-behaved, they might, without intending harm, speak of this windfall. It would be known all over Issoudun, and it is very important that our adversaries should not suspect it. You behave like a child."
In fact, before evening, many persons in Issoudun, including Max, were informed of this estimate, which had the immediate effect of causing a search for all the old paintings which no one had ever cared for, and the appearance of many execrable daubs. Max repented having driven the old man into giving away the pictures, and the rage he felt against the heirs, after hearing from Baruch old Auchan's ecclesiastical scheme, was increased by what he termed his own stupidity. The influence of religion upon such a feeble creature as Rouget was the one thing to fear. The news brought by his two comrades decided Maxence Gilet to turn all Rouget's investments into money, and to borrow upon his landed property so as to buy into the funds as soon as possible. But he considered it even more important to get rid of the Parisians at once. The genius of the Mascarilles and Scapins put together would hardly have solved the latter problem easily. Flore, acting by Max's advice, pretended that Monsieur was too feeble to take walks, and that he ought, at his age, to have a carriage.
This pretext grew out of the necessity of not exciting inquiry when they went to Bourges, Vierzon, Châteauroux, Vatan, and all the other places where the project of withdrawing investments obliged Max and Flore to betake themselves with Rouget. At the close of the week, all Issoudun was amazed to learn that the old man had gone to Bourges to buy a carriage, a step which the Knights of Idleness regarded as favourable to the Rabouilleuse. Flore and Max selected a hideous berlingot, with cracked leather curtains and windows without glass, aged 22 years and 9 campaigns, sold on the decease of a colonel, the friend of Grand Marshal Bertrand, who, during the absence of that faithful companion of the Emperor, was left in charge of the affairs of Berry. This berlingot, painted bright green, was somewhat like a calèche, though shafts had taken the place of a pole so that it could be driven with one horse. It belonged to a class of carriages brought into vogue by diminished fortunes, which at that time bore the candid name of demi-fortune. At its first introduction it was called a seringue. The cloth lining of this demi-fortune, sold under the name of calèche, was moth-eaten. Its gimps looked like the chevrons of an old invalide. Its rusty joints squeaked, but it only cost 450 francs, and Max bought a good stout mare, trained to harness, from an officer of a regiment then stationed at Bourges. He had the carriage repainted a dark brown, and bought a tolerable harness at a bargain. The whole town of Issoudun was shaken to its centre in expectation of Père Rouget's equipage, and on the occasion of its first appearance every household was on its doorstep, and curious faces were at all the windows. The second time the old bachelor went out, he drove to Bourges, where, to escape the trouble of attending personally to the business, or, if you prefer it, being ordered to do so by Flore, he went before a notary and signed a power of attorney in favour of Maxence Gilet, enabling him to make all the transfers enumerated in the document. Flore reserved to herself the business of making Monsieur sell out the investments in Issoudun and its immediate neighbourhood. The principal notary in Bourges was requested by Rouget to get him a loan of 140,000 francs on his landed estate. Nothing was known at Issoudun of these proceedings, which were secretly and cleverly carried out. Maxence, who was a good rider, went with his own horse to Bourges and back between 5 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon. Flore never left the old bachelor. Rouget consented without objection to the action Flore dictated to him, but he insisted that the investment in the funds, producing 50,000 francs a year, should stand in Flore's name as holding a life interest only, and in his as owner of the principal. The tenacity the old man displayed in the domestic disputes which this idea created caused Max a good deal of anxiety. He thought he could see the result of reflections inspired by the sight of the natural heirs. Amid all these movements, which Max concealed from the knowledge of everyone, he forgot the Spaniard and his granary. Fario came back to Issoudun to deliver his corn after various trips and business manoeuvres undertaken to raise the price of cereals. The morning after his arrival he noticed that the roof of the church of the Capuchins was black with pigeons. He cursed himself for having neglected to examine its condition, and hurried over to look into his storehouse, where he found half his grain devoured, thousands of mice marks and rat marks scattered about, showed a second cause of ruin.
The church was a Noah's ark. But anger turned the Spaniard white as a bit of cambric when, trying to estimate the extent of the destruction and his consequent losses, he noticed that the grain at the bottom of the heap, near the floor, was sprouting from the effects of water which Max had managed to introduce by means of tin tubes into the very center of the pile of wheat. The pigeons and the rats could be explained by animal instinct, but the hand of man was plainly visible in this last sign of malignity. Fario sat down on the steps of a chapel altar, holding his head between his hands. After half an hour of Spanish reflections, he spied the squirrel, which Godet could not refrain from giving him as a guest, playing with its tail upon a crossbeam, on the middle of which rested one of the uprights that supported the roof. The Spaniard rose and turned to his watchman with a face that was as calm and cold as an Arab's. He made no complaint, but went home, hired laborers to gather into sacks what remained of the sound grain, and to spread in the sun all that was moist, so as to save as much as possible. Then, after estimating that his losses amounted to about three-fifths, he attended to filling his orders. But his previous manipulations of the market had raised the price of cereals, and he lost on the three-fifths he was obliged to buy to fill his orders, so that his losses amounted really to more than half. The Spaniard, who had no enemies, at once attributed this revenge to Gilet. He was convinced that Maxence and some others were the authors of all the nocturnal mischief, and had in all probability carried his cart up the embankment of the tower, and now intended to amuse themselves by ruining him. It was a matter to him of over 3,000 francs, very nearly the whole capital he had scraped together since the peace. Driven by the desire for vengeance, the man now displayed the cunning and stealthy persistence of a detective to whom a large reward is offered. Hiding at night in different parts of Issoudun, he soon acquired proof of the proceedings of the Knights of Idleness. He saw them all, counted them, watched their rendezvous, and knew of their suppers at Merconiette's. After that he lay in wait to witness one of their deeds, and thus became well informed as to their nocturnal habits. In spite of Max's journeys and preoccupations, he had no intention of neglecting his nightly employments, first because he did not wish his comrades to suspect the secret of his operations with Père Rouget's property, and secondly, to keep the knights well in hand. They were therefore convened for the preparation of a prank which might deserve to be talked of for years to come. Poisoned meat was to be thrown, on a given night, to every watchdog in the town and in the environs. Fario overheard them congratulating each other, as they came out from a supper at the Cognettes, on the probable success of the performance, and laughing over the general mourning that would follow this novel massacre of the innocents, reveling, moreover, in the apprehensions it would excite as to the sinister object of depriving all the households of their guardian watchdogs. "It will make people forget Fario's cart," said Godet. Fario did not need that speech to confirm his suspicions. Besides, his mind was already made up. After 3 weeks' stay in Issoudun, Agathe was convinced, and so was Madame Auchan, of the truth of the old miser's observation that it would take years to destroy the influence which Max and the Rabouilleuse had acquired over her brother. She had made no progress in Jean-Jacques' confidence, and she was never left alone with him. On the other hand, Mademoiselle Brazier triumphed openly over the heirs by taking Agathe to drive in the calèche, sitting beside her on the back seat, while Monsieur Rouget and his nephew occupied the front. Mother and son impatiently awaited an answer to the confidential letter they had written to Desroches. The day before the night on which the dogs were to be poisoned, Joseph, who was nearly bored to death in Issoudun, received two letters. The first from the great painter Schinner, whose age allowed him a closer intimacy than Joseph could have with Gros, their master, and the second from Desroches. Here is the first, postmarked Beaumont-sur-Oise. My dear Joseph, I have just finished the principal panel paintings at the Chateau de Presles for the Comte de Sérisy. I have left all the mouldings and the decorative painting, and I have recommended you so strongly to the Count and also to Guido, the architect, that you have nothing to do but pick up your brushes and come at once. Prices are arranged to please you. I am off to Italy with my wife, so you can have Mistigui to help you along. The young scamp has talent, and I put him at your disposal. He is twittering like a sparrow at the very idea of amusing himself at the Chateau de Presles. Adieu, my dear Joseph. If I am still absent, and should send nothing to next year's salon, you must take my place. Yes, dear Jojo, I know your picture is a masterpiece, but a masterpiece which will rouse a hue and cry about romanticism. You are doomed to lead the life of a devil in holy water. Adieu, thy friend Schinner. Here follows the letter of Desroches. My dear Joseph, your Monsieur Auchan strikes me as an old man full of common sense, and you give me a high idea of his methods. He is perfectly right. My advice, since you ask it, is that your mother should remain at Issoudun with Madame Auchan, paying a small board, say 400 francs a year, to reimburse her hosts for what she eats. Madame Brideau ought, in my opinion, to follow Monsieur Auchan's advice in everything, for your excellent mother will have many scruples in dealing with persons who have no scruple at all, and whose behavior to her is a master stroke of policy. That Maxence, you are right enough, is dangerous. He is another Philippe, but of a different caliber. The scoundrel makes his vices serve his fortunes, and gets his amusement gratis, whereas your brother's follies are never useful to him. All that you say alarms me, but I could do no good by going to Issoudun. Monsieur Auchan, acting behind your mother, will be more useful to you than I. As for you, you had better come back here. You are good for nothing in a matter which requires continual attention, careful observation, servile civilities, discretion in speech, and a dissimulation of manner and gesture, which is wholly against the grain of artists. If they have told you no will has been made, you may be quite sure they have possessed one for a long time. But wills can be revoked, and as long as your fool of an uncle lives, he is no doubt susceptible of being worked upon by remorse and religion. Your inheritance will be the result of a combat between the church and the rabouilleuse. There will inevitably come a time when that woman will lose her grip on the old man, and religion will be all-powerful. So long as your uncle makes no gift of the property during his lifetime, and does not change the nature of his estate, all may come right whenever religion gets the upper hand. For this reason,
you must beg Monsieur Auchan to keep an eye, as well as he can, on the condition of your uncle's property. It is necessary to know if the real estate is mortgaged, and if so, where and in whose name the proceeds are invested. It is so easy to terrify an old man with fears about his life, in case you find him despoiling his own property for the sake of those interlopers, that almost any heir with a little adroitness could stop the spoliation at its outset. But how should your mother, with her ignorance of the world, her disinterestedness, and her religious ideas, know how to manage such an affair? However, I am not able to throw any light on the matter. All that you have done so far has probably given the alarm, and your adversaries may already have secured themselves.
"That is what I call an opinion in good shape," exclaimed Monsieur Auchan, proud of being himself appreciated by a Parisian lawyer.
"Oh, Desroches is a famous fellow," answered Joseph.
"It would be well to read that letter to the two women," said the old man.
"There it is," said Joseph, giving it to him. "As to me, I want to be off tomorrow, and I am now going to say good-bye to my uncle."
"Ah," said Monsieur Auchan, "I see that Monsieur Desroches tells you in a postscript to burn the letter."
"You can burn it after showing it to my mother," said the painter.
Joseph dressed, crossed the little square, and called on his uncle, who was just finishing breakfast. Max and Flore were at table.
"Don't disturb yourself, my dear uncle. I have only come to say good-bye."
"You are going?" said Max, exchanging glances with Flore.
"Yes, I have some work to do at the chateau of Monsieur de Serizy, and I am all the more glad of it because his arm is long enough to do a service to my poor brother in the Chamber of Peers."
"Well, well, go and work," said old Rouget with a silly air.
Joseph thought him extraordinarily changed within a few days.
"Men must work. I am sorry you are going."
"Oh, my mother will be here some time longer," remarked Joseph.
Max made a movement with his lips which the Rabouilleuse observed, and which signified, "They are going to try the plan Baruch warned me of."
"I am very glad I came," said Joseph, "for I have had the pleasure of making your acquaintance, and you have enriched my studio."
"Yes," said Flore, "instead of enlightening your uncle on the value of his pictures, which is now estimated at over 100,000 francs, you have packed them off in a hurry to Paris. Poor dear man, he is no better than a baby. We have just been told of a little treasure at Bourges. What did they call it? A poussin, which was in the choir of the cathedral before the Revolution, and is now worth, all by itself, 30,000 francs.
"That was not right of you, my nephew," said Jean-Jacques, at a sign from Max, which Joseph could not see.
"Come now, frankly," said the soldier, laughing. "On your honour, what should you say those pictures were worth? You've made an easy haul out of your uncle, and right enough, too. Uncles are made to be pillaged. Nature deprived me of uncles, but damn it, if I'd had any, I should have shown them no mercy."
"Did you know, monsieur," said Flore to Rouget, "what your pictures were worth? How much did you say, Monsieur Joseph?"
"Well," answered the painter, who had grown as red as a beetroot, "the pictures are certainly worth something."
"They say you estimated them to Monsieur Auchan at 150,000 francs, said Flore. "Is that true?"
"Yes," said the painter, with childlike honesty.
"And did you intend," said Flore to the old man, "to give 150,000 francs to your nephew?"
"Never, never," cried Jean-Jacques, on whom Flore had fixed her eye.
"There is one way to settle all this," said the painter, "and that is to return them to you, uncle."
"No, no, keep them," said the old man.
"I shall send them back to you," said Joseph, wounded by the offensive silence of Max and Flore. "There is something in my brushes which will make my fortune without owing anything to anyone, even an uncle. My respects to you, mademoiselle. Good day, monsieur."
And Joseph crossed the square in a state of irritation which artists can imagine. The entire Auchan family were in the salon. When they saw Joseph gesticulating and talking to himself, they asked him what was the matter. The painter, who was as open as the day, related, before Baruch and François, the scene that had just taken place, and which 2 hours later, thanks to the two young men, was the talk of the whole town, embroidered with various circumstances that were more or less ridiculous. Some persons insisted that the painter was maltreated by Max, others that he had misbehaved to Flore, and that Max had turned him out of doors.
"What a child your son is," said Auchan to Madame Bridau. "The booby is the dupe of a scene which they have been keeping back for the last day of his visit. Max and the Rabouilleuse have known the value of those pictures for the last 2 weeks. Ever since he had the folly to tell it before my grandsons, who never rested till they had blurted it out to all the world, your artist had better have taken himself off without taking leave."
"My son has done right to return the pictures if they are really so valuable," said Agathe.
"If they are worth, as he says, 200,000 francs," said old Auchan, "it was folly to put himself in the way of being obliged to return them. You might have had that, at least, out of the property, whereas, as things are going now, you won't get anything. And this scene with Joseph is almost a reason why your brother should refuse to see you again."
End of chapter 12.
Chapter 13 of The Two Brothers by Honoré de Balzac, translated by Catherine Prescott Wormley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bruce Peary. Between midnight and 1 o'clock, the Knights of Idleness began their gratuitous distribution of comestibles to the dogs of the town. This memorable expedition was not over till 3 in the morning, the hour at which these reprobates went to sup at Cognette's. At 4:30, in the early dawn, they crept home. Just as Max turned the corner of the Rue Lavenier into the Grande Rue, Fario, who stood ambushed in a recess, struck a knife at his heart, drew out the blade, and escaped by the moat towards Villette, wiping the blade of his knife on his handkerchief. The Spaniard washed the handkerchief in the Riviere Forcée, and returned quietly to his lodgings at Saint-Paterne, where he got in by a window he had left open, and went to bed. Later he was awakened by his new watchman, who found him fast asleep. As he fell, Max uttered a fearful cry which no one could mistake. Lousteau Plongeon, son of a judge, a distant relation of the family of the sub-delegate, and young Godet, who lived at the lower end of the Grande Rue, ran at full speed up the street, calling to each other, "They're killing Max! Help! Help!" But not a dog barked. And all the town, accustomed to the false alarms of these nightly prowlers, stayed quietly in their beds. When his two comrades reached him, Max had fainted. It was necessary to rouse Monsieur Godet, the surgeon. Max had recognized Fario, but when he came to his senses with several persons about him and felt that his wound was not mortal, it suddenly occurred to him to make capital out of the attack,
and he said in a faint voice, "I think I recognized that cursed painter."
Thereupon Lousteau Plongin ran off to his father, the judge. Max was carried home by Cognette, young Godet, and two other persons. Mère Cognette and Monsieur Godet walked beside the stretcher. Those who carried the wounded man naturally looked across at Monsieur Auchan's door while waiting for Kowski to let them in, and saw Monsieur Auchan's servant sweeping the stairs. At the old miser's, as everywhere else in the provinces, the household was early astir. The few words uttered by Max had roused the suspicions of Monsieur Godet, and he called to the woman. "Greet! Is Monsieur Joseph Brideau in bed?"
"Bless me," she said. "He went out at 4:30. I don't know what ailed him. He walked up and down his room all night."
This simple answer drew forth such exclamations of horror that the woman came over, curious to know what they were carrying to old Rouget's house. "A precious fellow he is, that painter of yours," they said to her. And the procession entered the house, leaving Greet open-mouthed with amazement at the sight of Max in his bloody shirt, stretched half-fainting on a mattress. Artists will readily guess what ailed Joseph and kept him restless all night. He imagined the tale the bourgeoisie of Issoudun would tell of him. They would say he had fleeced his uncle, that he was everything but what he had tried to be, a loyal fellow and an honest artist. Ah, he would have given his great picture to have flown like a swallow to Paris and thrown his uncle's paintings at Max's nose. To be the one robbed, and to be thought the robber. What irony! So, at the earliest dawn, he had started for the popular avenue which led to Tivoli, to give free course to his agitation. While the innocent fellow was vowing, by way of consolation, never to return to Issoudun, Max was preparing a horrible outrage for his sensitive spirit. When Monsieur Godet had probed the wound and discovered that the knife, turned aside by a little pocket-book, had happily spared Max's life, though making a serious wound, he did as all doctors, and particularly country surgeons, do. He paved the way for his own credit by not answering for the patient's life. And then, after dressing the soldier's wound and stating the verdict of science to the Rabouilleuse, Jean-Jacques Rouget, Kowski, and the Védie, he left the house. The Rabouilleuse came in tears to her dear Max, while Kowski and the Védie told the assembled crowd that the captain was in a fair way to die. The news brought nearly 200 persons in groups about the Place Saint-Jean and the two Narettes. "I shan't be a month in bed, and I know who struck the blow," whispered Max to Flore. "But we'll profit by it to get rid of the Parisians. I have said I thought I recognized the painter, so pretend that I am expected to die, and try to have Joseph Brideau arrested. Let him taste a prison for a couple of days, and I know well enough the mother will be off in a jiffy for Paris when she gets him out. And then we needn't fear the priests they talk of setting on the old fool." When Flore Brazier came downstairs, she found the assembled crowd quite prepared to take the impression she meant to give them. She went out with tears in her eyes and related, sobbing, how the painter, who had just the face for that sort of thing, had been angry with Max the night before about some pictures he had wormed out of Père Rouget. "That brigand, for you've only got to look at him to see what he is, thinks that if Max were dead, his uncle would leave him his fortune. As if," she cried, "a brother were not more to him than a nephew.
Max is Dr. Rouget's son. The old one told me so before he died.
Ah, he meant to do the deed just before he left Issoudun. He chose his time, for he was going away today, said one of the knights of idleness.
Max hasn't an enemy in Issoudun, said another.
Besides, Max recognized the painter, said the Rabouilleuse.
Where's that cursed Parisian? Let us find him, they all cried.
Find him, was the answer. Why, he left Monsieur Auchan's at daybreak.
A knight of idleness ran off at once to Monsieur Mouilleron. The crowd increased, and the tumult became threatening. Excited groups filled up the whole of the Grande Narette. Others stationed themselves before the Church of Saint-Jean. An assemblage gathered at the Porte Villate, which is at the farther end of the Petite Narette. Monsieur Lousteau-Prangin and Monsieur Mouilleron, the commissary of police, the lieutenant of gendarmes, and two of his men, had some difficulty in reaching the Place Saint-Jean through two hedges of people, whose cries and exclamations could and did prejudice them against the Parisian, who was, it is needless to say, unjustly accused, although, it is true, circumstances told against him. After a conference between Max and the magistrates, Monsieur Mouilleron sent the commissary of police and a sergeant with one gendarme to examine what, in the language of the Ministry of the Interior, is called the theatre of the crime. Then Monsieur Mouilleron and Lousteau-Prangin, accompanied by the lieutenant of gendarmes, crossed over to the Auchan house, which was now guarded by two gendarmes in the garden and two at the front door. The crowd was still increasing. The whole town was surging in the Grande Rue. Griet had rushed, terrified, to her master, crying out,
"Monsieur, we shall be pillaged. The town is in revolt. Monsieur Maxence Gillet has been assassinated. He is dying. And they say it is Monsieur Joseph who has done it."
Monsieur Auchan dressed quickly and came downstairs, but seeing the angry populace, he hastily retreated within the house and bolted the door. On questioning Griet, he learned that his guest had left the house at daybreak, after walking the floor all night in great agitation, and had not yet come in. Much alarmed, he went to find Madame Auchan, who was already awakened by the noise, and to whom he told the frightful news which, true or false, was causing almost a riot in Issoudun.
"He is innocent, of course," said Madame Auchan.
"Before his innocence can be proved, the crowd may get in here and pillage us," said Monsieur Auchan, livid with fear, for he had gold in his cellar.
"Where is Agathe?"
"Sound asleep."
"Ah, so much the better," said Madame Auchan. "I wish she may sleep on till the matter is cleared up. Such a shock might kill the poor child."
But Agathe woke up and came down half-dressed, for the evasive answers of Griet, whom she questioned, had disturbed both her head and heart. She found Madame Auchan looking very pale, with her eyes full of tears, at one of the windows of the salon beside her husband.
"Courage, my child. God sends us our afflictions," said the old lady. "Joseph is accused."
"Of what?"
"Of a bad action which he could never have committed," answered Madame Auchan.
Hearing the words and seeing the lieutenant of gendarmes, who at this moment entered the room accompanied by the two gentlemen, Agathe fainted away.
"There now," said Monsieur Auchan to his wife and Griet, "carry off Madame Rideau. Women are only in the way at these times. Take her to her room, and stay there, both of you. Sit down, gentlemen," continued the old man. "The mistake to which we owe your visit will soon, I hope, be cleared up."
"Even if it should be a mistake," said Monsieur Mouilleron,
The excitement of the crowd is so great, and their minds are so exasperated, that I fear for the safety of the accused. I should like to get him arrested, and that might satisfy these people. Who would ever have believed that Monsieur Maxence Gilet had inspired so much affection in this town? Asked Lousteau Prangin. One of my men says there's a crowd of 1,200 more just coming in from the Faubourg de Rome, said the lieutenant of gendarmes, and they are threatening death to the assassin. Where is your guest? Said Monsieur Mouilleron to Monsieur Auchan. He has gone to walk in the country, I believe. Call Greet, said the judge gravely. I was in hopes he had not left the house. You are aware that the crime was committed not far from here, at daybreak. While Monsieur Auchan went to find Greet, the three functionaries looked at each other significantly. I never liked that painter's face, said the lieutenant to Monsieur Mouilleron. My good woman, said the judge to Greet when she appeared, they say you saw Monsieur Joseph Brideau leave the house this morning?
Yes, monsieur, she answered, trembling like a leaf.
At what hour?
Just as I was getting up. He walked about his room all night, and was dressed when I came downstairs.
Was it daylight?
Barely.
Did he seem excited?
Yes, he was all of a twitter.
Send one of your men for my clerk, said Lousteau Planchin to the lieutenant, and tell him to bring warrants with him. Good God, don't be in such a hurry, cried Monsieur Auchan. The young man's agitation may have been caused by something besides the premeditation of this crime. He meant to return to Paris today to attend to a matter in which Gilet and Mademoiselle Brazier had doubted his honor. Yes, the affair of the pictures, said Monsieur Mouilleron. Those pictures caused a very hot quarrel between them yesterday, and it is a word and a blow with artists, they tell me.
Who is there in Issoudun who had any object in killing Gilet? Said Lousteau.
No one, neither a jealous husband nor anybody else, for the fellow has never harmed a soul. But what was Monsieur Gilet doing in the streets at 4 in the morning? Remarked Monsieur Auchan.
Now, Monsieur Auchan, you must allow us to manage this affair in our own way, answered Mouilleron. You don't know all. Gilet recognized your painter.
At this instant a clamor was heard from the other end of the town, growing louder and louder, like the roll of thunder, as it followed the course of the Grande Narette.
"Here he is! Here he is! He's arrested!"
These words rose distinctly on the ear above the hoarse roar of the populace. Poor Joseph, returning quietly past the mill at Landrôle, intending to get home in time for breakfast, was spied by the various groups of people as soon as he reached the Place Misère. Happily for him, a couple of gendarmes arrived on a run in time to snatch him from the inhabitants of the Faubourg de Rome, who had already pinioned him by the arms and were threatening him with death.
"Give way, give way!" cried the gendarmes, calling to some of their comrades to help them, and putting themselves one before and the other behind Brideau. "You see, monsieur," said the one who held the painter, "it concerns our skin as well as yours at this moment. Innocent or guilty, we must protect you against the tumult raised by the murder of Captain Gilet, and the crowd is not satisfied with suspecting you. They declare, hard as iron, that you are the murderer. Monsieur Gilet is adored by all the people who, look at them, want to take justice into their own hands. Didn't we see them in 1830 dusting the jackets of the tax-gatherers, whose life isn't a bed of roses, anyway?"
Joseph Brideau grew pale as death, and collected all his strength to walk onward.
After all, he said, I am innocent. Go on.
Poor artist, he was forced to bear his cross. Amid the hooting and insults and threats from the mob, he made the dreadful transit from the Place Misère to the Place Saint-Jean. The gendarmes were obliged to draw their sabres on the furious mob, which pelted them with stones. One of the officers was wounded, and Joseph received several of the missiles on his legs and shoulders and hat. "Here we are," said one of the gendarmes as they entered Monsieur Auchan's hall, "and not without difficulty, Lieutenant." "We must now manage to disperse the crowd, and I see but one way, gentlemen," said the lieutenant to the magistrates. "We must take Monsieur Bridau to the Palais, accompanied by all of you. I and my gendarmes will make a circle round you. One can't answer for anything in presence of a furious crowd of 6,000. "You are right," said Monsieur Auchan, who was trembling all the while for his gold.
"If that's your only way to protect innocence in Issoudun," said Joseph, "I congratulate you. I came near being stoned."
"Do you wish your friend's house to be taken by assault and pillaged?" asked the lieutenant. "Could we beat back with our sabres a crowd of people who are pushed from behind by an angry populace that knows nothing of the forms of justice?"
"That will do, gentlemen. Let us go. We can come to explanations later," said Joseph, who had recovered his self-possession.
"Give way, friends," said the lieutenant to the crowd. "He is arrested, and we are taking him to the Palais."
"Respect the law, friends," said Monsieur Mouilleron.
"Wouldn't you prefer to see him guillotined?"
said one of the gendarmes to an angry group.
"Yes, yes, they shall guillotine him," shouted one madman. "They are going to guillotine him," cried the women.
By the time they reached the end of the Grande Narette, the crowd were shouting,
"They are taking him to the guillotine. They found the knife upon him. That's what Parisians are. He carries crime on his face."
Though all Joseph's blood had flown to his head, he walked the distance from the Place Saint-Jean to the Palais with remarkable calmness and self-possession. Nevertheless, he was very glad to find himself in the private office of Monsieur Lousteau Planchet.
"I need hardly tell you, gentlemen, that I am innocent," said Joseph, addressing Monsieur Mouilleron, Monsieur Lousteau Planchet, and the clerk. "I can only beg you to assist me in proving my innocence. I know nothing of this affair."
When the judge had stated all the suspicious facts which were against him, ending with Max's declaration, Joseph was astounded.
"But," said he, "it was past 5 o'clock when I left the house. I went up the Grand Rue, and at 5:30 I was standing looking up at the façade of the parish church of Saint-Cyr. I talked there with the sexton, who came to ring the Angelus, and asked him for information about the building, which seems to me fantastic and incomplete. Then I passed through the vegetable market, where some women had already assembled. From there, crossing the Place Misère, I went as far as the Mill of Landreau by the Pont aux Ânes, where I watched the ducks for 5 or 6 minutes, and the miller's men must have noticed me. I saw the women going to wash. They're probably still there. They made a little fun of me and declared that I was not handsome. I told them that it was not all gold that glittered. From there, I followed the long avenue to Tivoli, where I talked with the gardener. Pray, have these facts verified, and do not even arrest me, for I give you my word of honour that I will stay quietly in this office till you are convinced of my innocence." These sensible words, said without the least hesitation, and with the ease of a man who is perfectly sure of his facts, made some impression on the magistrates.
"Yes, we must find all these persons and summon them," said Monsieur Mouilleron, "but it is more than the affair of a day.
Make up your mind, therefore, in your own interests, to be imprisoned in the Palais.
Provided I can write to my mother so as to reassure her, poor woman.
Oh, you can read the letter, he added.
This request was too just not to be granted, and Joseph wrote the following letter.
Do not be uneasy, dear mother. The mistake of which I am a victim can easily be rectified. I have already given them the means of doing so. Tomorrow, or perhaps this evening, I shall be at liberty. I kiss you, and beg you to say to Monsieur and Madame Auchan how grieved I am at this affair, in which, however, I have had no hand. It is the result of some chance which, as yet, I do not understand.
When the note reached Madame Rideau, she was suffering from a nervous attack, and the potions which Monsieur Godet was trying to make her swallow were powerless to soothe her. The reading of the letter acted like balm. After a few quiverings, Agathe subsided into the depression which always follows such attacks. Later, when Monsieur Godet returned to his patient, he found her regretting that she had ever quitted Paris.
"Well," said Madame Auchan to Monsieur Godet, "how is Monsieur Gilet?"
"His wound, though serious, is not mortal," replied the doctor. "With a month's nursing, he will be all right. I left him writing to Monsieur Mouilleron to request him to set your son at liberty, madame," he added, turning to Agathe. "Oh, Max is a fine fellow. I told him what a state you were in, and he then remembered a circumstance which goes to prove that the assassin was not your son. The man wore list shoes, whereas it is certain that Monsieur Joseph left the house in his boots."
"Ah, God forgive him the harm he has done me."
"The fact was, a man had left a note for Max after dark, written in type letters, which ran as follows: Captain Gilet ought not to let an innocent man suffer. He who struck the blow promises not to strike again, if Monsieur Gilet will have Monsieur Joseph Brideau set at liberty, without naming the man who did it." After reading this letter and burning it, Max wrote to Monsieur Mouilleron stating the circumstance of the list shoes, as reported by Monsieur Godet, begging him to set Joseph at liberty, and to come and see him that he might explain the matter more at length. By the time this letter was received, Monsieur Lousteau-Planchon had verified, by the testimony of the bell-ringer, the market-women and washerwomen, and the miller's men, the truth of Joseph's explanation. Max's letter made his innocence only the more certain, and Monsieur Mouilleron himself escorted him back to the Auchans. Joseph was greeted with such overflowing tenderness by his mother that the poor misunderstood son gave thanks to ill luck, like the husband to the thief in La Fontaine's fable, for a mishap which brought him such proofs of affection. "Oh," said Monsieur Mouilleron, with a self-satisfied air, "I knew at once, by the way you looked at the angry crowd, that you were innocent. But whatever I may have thought, anyone who knows Issoudun must also know that the only way to protect you was to make the arrest, as we did. Ah, you carried your head high."
"I was thinking of something else," said the artist simply. "An officer in the army told me that he was once stopped in Dalmatia under similar circumstances by an excited populace in the early morning as he was returning from a walk. This recollection came into my mind, and I looked at all those heads with the idea of painting a revolt of the year 1793. Besides, I kept saying to myself,
blackguard that I am! I have only got my deserts for coming here to look after an inheritance instead of painting in my studio.
If you will allow me to offer you a piece of advice, said the procureur du roi, you will take a carriage to-night, which the postmaster will lend you, and return to Paris by the diligence from Bourges.
That is my advice also, said Monsieur Auchan, who was burning with a desire for the departure of his guests.
My most earnest wish is to get away from Issoudun, though I leave my only friend here, said Agathe, kissing Madame Auchan's hand. When shall I see you again?
Ah, my dear, never until we meet above.
We have suffered enough here below, she added in a low voice, for God to take pity upon us.
Shortly after, while Monsieur Mouilleron had gone across the way to talk with Max, Greet greatly astonished Monsieur and Madame Auchan, Agathe, Joseph, and Adelphine by announcing the visit of Monsieur Bourget. Jean-Jacques came to bid his sister good-bye and to offer her his caleche for the drive to Bourges.
"Ah, your pictures have been a great evil to us," said Agathe.
"Keep them, my sister," said the old man, who did not even now believe in their value.
"Neighbor," remarked Monsieur Auchan, "our best friends, our surest defenders, are our own relations, above all when they are such as your sister Agathe and your nephew Joseph."
"Perhaps so," said old Rouget in his dull way.
"We ought all to think of ending our days in a Christian manner," said Madame Auchan.
"Ah, Jean-Jacques," said Agathe, "what a day this has been."
"Will you accept my carriage?" asked Rouget.
"No, brother," answered Madame Brideau. "I thank you, and wish you health and comfort."
Rouget let his sister and nephew kiss him, and then he went away without manifesting any feeling himself. Baruch, at a hint from his grandfather, had been to see the postmaster. At 11 o'clock that night, the two Parisians, ensconced in a wicker cabriolet drawn by one horse and ridden by a postillion, quitted Issoudun. Adelphine and Madame Auchan parted from them with tears in their eyes. They alone regretted Joseph and Agathe.
"They are gone," said François Auchan, going with the Rabouilleuse into Max's bedroom.
"Well done, the trick succeeded," answered Max, who was now tired and feverish.
"But what did you say to old Mouilleron?" asked François.
"I told him that I had given my assassin some cause to waylay me, that he was a dangerous man, and likely, if I followed up the affair, to kill me like a dog before he could be captured. Consequently, I begged Mouilleron and Planchon to make the most active search ostensibly, but really to let the assassin go in peace, unless they wished to see me a dead man."
"I do hope, Max," said Flore, "that you will be quiet at night for some time to come."
"At any rate, we are delivered from the Parisians," cried Max. "The fellow who stabbed me had no idea what a service he was doing us." The next day, the departure of the Parisians was celebrated as a victory of the provinces over Paris by everyone in Issoudun, except the more sober and staid inhabitants who shared the opinions of Monsieur and Madame Auchan. A few of Max's friends spoke very harshly of the Brideaus.
"Do those Parisians fancy we are all idiots?"
cried one, "and think they have only got to hold their hats and catch legacies?
They came to fleece, but they have got shorn themselves," said another. "The nephew is not to the uncle's taste."
"And, if you please, they actually consulted a lawyer in Paris."
"Ah, had they really a plan?" "Why, of course, a plan to get possession of old Rouget. But the Parisians were not clever enough. That lawyer can't crow over us Berrichons."
"How abominable!"
"That's Paris for you."
"The Rabouilleuse knew they came to attack her, and she defended herself."
"She did gloriously right."
To the townspeople at large, the Brideaus were Parisians and foreigners. They preferred Max and Flore. We can imagine the satisfaction with which, after this campaign, Joseph and Agathe re-entered their little lodging in the Rue Mazarin. On the journey, the artist recovered his spirits, which had not unnaturally been put to flight by his arrest and 24 hours' confinement. But he could not cheer up his mother. The Court of Peers was about to begin the trial of the military conspirators, and that was sufficient to keep Agathe from recovering her peace of mind. Philippe's conduct, in spite of the clever defender whom Desroches recommended to him, roused suspicions that were unfavorable to his character. In view of this, Joseph, as soon as he had put Desroches in possession of all that was going on at Issoudun, started with Mistigris for the chateau of the Comte de Serizy to escape hearing about the trial of the conspirators, which lasted for 20 days. It is useless to record facts that may be found in contemporaneous histories. Whether it were that he played a part previously agreed upon, or that he was really an informer, Philippe was condemned to 5 years' surveillance by the police department, and ordered to leave Paris the same day for Autun, the town which the director-general of police selected as the place of his exile for 5 years. This punishment resembled the detention of prisoners on parole who have a town for a prison. Learning that the Comte de Serizy, one of the peers appointed by the chamber on the court-martial, was employing Joseph to decorate his chateau at Prales, Desroches begged the minister to grant him an audience, and found Monsieur de Serizy most amiably disposed toward Joseph, with whom he had happened to make personal acquaintance. Desroches explained the financial condition of the two brothers, recalling the services of the father and the neglect shown to them under the Restoration. "Such injustice, Monseigneur," said the lawyer, "is a lasting cause of irritation and discontent. You knew the father. Give the sons a chance, at least, of making a fortune." And he drew a succinct picture of the situation of the family affairs at Issoudun, begging the all-powerful vice-president of the Council of State to take steps to induce the director-general of police to change Philippe's place of residence from Autun to Issoudun. He also spoke of Philippe's extreme poverty, and asked a dole of 60 francs a month, which the Minister of War ought, he said, for mere shame's sake, to grant to a former lieutenant-colonel. "I will obtain all you ask of me, for I think it just," replied the Count. 3 days later, Desroches, furnished with the necessary authority, fetched Philippe from the prison of the Court of Peers, and took him to his own house, Rue de Béthisy. Once there, the young barrister read the miserable vagabond one of those unanswerable lectures in which lawyers rate things at their actual value,
using plain terms to qualify the conduct and to analyze and reduce to their simplest meaning the sentiments and ideas of clients toward whom they feel enough interest to speak plainly. After humbling the emperor's staff officer by reproaching him with his reckless dissipations, his mother's misfortunes, and the death of Madame Descoings, he went on to tell him the state of things at Issoudun, explaining it according to his lights, and probing both the scheme and the character of Maxence Gilet and the Rabouilleuse to their depths. Philippe, who was gifted with a keen comprehension in such directions, listened with much more interest to this part of Desroches's lecture than to what had gone before. "Under these circumstances," continued the lawyer, "you can repair the injury you have done to your estimable family, so far at least as it is repairable, for you cannot restore life to the poor mother you have all but killed. But you alone can..." "What can I do?" asked Philippe. "I have obtained a change of residence for you, from Autun to Issoudun." Philippe's sunken face, which had grown almost sinister in expression and was furrowed with sufferings and privation, instantly lighted up with a flash of joy. "And, as I was saying, you alone can recover the inheritance of old Rouget's property, half of which may by this time be in the jaws of the wolf named Gilet," replied Desroches. "You now know all the particulars, and it is for you to act accordingly. I suggest no plan. I have no ideas at all as to that. Besides, everything will depend on local circumstances. You have to deal with a strong force. That fellow is very astute. The way he attempted to get back the pictures your uncle had given to Joseph, the audacity with which he laid a crime on your poor brother's shoulders, all go to prove that the adversary is capable of everything. Therefore, be prudent, and try to behave properly out of policy if you can't do so out of decency. Without telling Joseph, whose artist's pride would be up in arms, I have sent the pictures to Monsieur Auchan, telling him to give them up to no one but you. By the way, Maxence Gilet is a brave man." "So much the better," said Philippe. "I count on his courage for success. A coward would leave Issoudun." "Well, think of your mother, who has been so devoted to you, and of your brother, whom you made your milch cow." "Ah, did he tell you that nonsense?" cried Philippe. "Am I not the friend of the family, and don't I know much more about you than they do?" asked Desroches. "What do you know?" said Philippe. "That you betrayed your comrades." "I," exclaimed Philippe, "I, a staff officer of the emperor? Absurd! Why, we fooled the Chamber of Peers, the lawyers, the government, and the whole of the damned concern. The king's people were completely hoodwinked." "That's all very well, if it was so," answered the lawyer. "But don't you see, the Bourbons can't be overthrown. All Europe is backing them, and you ought to try to make your peace with the War Department. You could do that readily enough if you were rich. To get rich, you and your brother, you must lay hold of your uncle. If you will take the trouble to manage an affair which needs great cleverness, patience, and caution, you have enough work before you to occupy your 5 years." "No, no," cried Philippe, "I must take the bull by the horns at once. This Maxence may alter the investment of the property and put it in that woman's name, and then all would be lost." "Monsieur Auchan is a good adviser and sees clearly. Consult him. You have your orders from the police. I have taken your place in the Orléans diligence for 7:30 this evening. I suppose your trunk is ready, so now come and dine. I own nothing but what I have got on my back, said Philippe, opening his horrible blue overcoat. But I only need three things, which you must tell Giraudeau, the uncle of Finot, to send me. My sabre, my sword, and my pistols.
You need more than that, said the lawyer, shuddering as he looked at his client. You will receive a quarterly stipend, which will clothe you decently.
Bless me, are you here, Godeschal? Cried Philippe, recognizing in Desroches' head clerk, as they passed out, the brother of Mariette.
Yes, I have been with Monsieur Desroches for the last 2 months.
And he will stay with me, I hope, till he gets a business of his own, said Desroches.
How is Mariette? Asked Philippe, moved at his recollections.
She is getting ready for the opening of the new theatre.
It would cost her little trouble to get my sentence remitted, said Philippe. However, as she chooses.
After a meagre dinner given by Desroches, who boarded his head clerk, the two lawyers put the political convict in the diligence and wished him good luck. End of chapter 13.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.